The method.
Idea. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of Unsound Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow authors of literary fiction about their process, their techniques, and some of the motivations they have for writing.
In this, the sixth episode, we're speaking to Alex Phoebe, who is the author of Grace, Playthings and Lucia, which is forthcoming on Gallibega Press this spring.
We both wanted to speak to Alex, really having read Playthings, which deals with a fictional account of a real-life person, Daniel Paul Schreiber, who was a German judge around the turn of the last century, and he wrote one of the first-person accounts of madness and schizophrenia while he was incarcerated.
Speaking to Alex, we found out a lot about how he works, and it was really interesting to speak to him about his work ethic and the hefty 3,000 words a day that he considers no big deal to churn out, and also the different facets that a novelist needs to have: the writing side of you, the thinking side of you, the editing side of you.
We also discuss some of the potential links between schizophrenia and madness and the writing process itself, and went on to discuss whether there was any reason to have a belief in an external reality at all.
Well, without any further ado, Alex Phoebe.
So I guess a good place to start is how you sort of started writing seriously.
Seriously? What did I do? Let me think. Because I've always written unseriously, basically continuously since I was a kid. One thing or another. I went through a big D&D phase when I was a kind of 10, 11, something like that. And kept on writing things and drawing maps and that kind of stuff that D&D type kids do. And then wrote kind of in various things throughout my 20s. Finished a couple of novels, but never did anything with them. I wasn't really interested in trying to sell them or anything. I didn't know how, anyway. And I was busy. I used to work in a restaurant washing up, and also as a chef for a bit. So I was busy doing stuff. And I was also worked as a kind of PhD student in art history and aesthetics. So I had a lot of stuff going on that wasn't writing-related. And then got into my 30s, I guess, and there was a time where my wife and I just got married by that point, had for some reason more money than we needed. So I went part-time at work and did a master's at Goldsmiths over the road as a way of taking the writing more seriously, because I'd always written, and consequently, you know, it got to the point where I thought, what would I like to do? I mean, I got 30-something, I was thinking, well, what do you want to do? It's a bit late incoming, but... So I thought, okay, well, you know, I'd like to write. Right? And I've always tried, so I thought, I'll have a go. And I wrote a couple of short stories and got published. So the first short story I wrote was for Comma Press. They had a kind of call for short stories based in Manchester on Gothic themes. So I sent them this thing that I'd written, and they published it. Got £100, as I recall, which turned out to be pretty good. I didn't realise at the time, £100. Yeah, it turned out to be quite a lot. And had a kind of experience of doing that. It was a bit of a kind of wrestling match with Ra Page over swearing, things like that, and whether I could mention. The story was about a guy who got beaten up by the police. And then it turned out that the police were co-sponsoring the magazine that the thing was going to come in, Greater Manchester Police. Yeah, some problems with the sponsors, so consequently you had to take that bit out and put something else in, blah, blah, blah. So that kind of made me think that perhaps it was worth carrying on with. And then I'd been working, one of the things I was working on in my 20s, I kind of took with me to Goldsmiths and used as a basis for... assignments, that kind of stuff, and workshop things. And eventually that kind of got to the point in which it was finished. And I was published again in Goldsmith's anthology. Another short story again about someone who'd been beaten up and was dying this time. And that got published. And an agent read that. And then the agent said, have you got anything, any longer form stuff, any novels? And I had, because I'd finished this other novel. And that was my first novel, Grace, which is around somewhere, which was published by Two Ravens, who are now kind of basically defunct press that used to operate out of Scotland. And lots of their people went on to Salt. I know Alison Thingamajig, names, I'm not great with names, who did The Falconer. Oh, God. Yeah, you're thinking something. You think it's not that woman, it's someone else. And then a bunch of other people, look them up. I mean, you'll see them. Sold them to them. And then at that point, I was thinking, this is while I was still doing still before I started doing the PhD, because then I thought, well, what I'll do is, because I got to the point where I was offered a place at Columbia to do a PhD in aesthetics and art history under Rosalind Krauss, the surrealist, in the 90s, and didn't manage to get the money together because they wanted like a vast sum of money. It's like even worse than it is now. The fees were $20,000 a year, and then you had to also have like $30,000 to get by on, because you weren't allowed to work, so the visa requirements. And I tried to borrow the money from Fannie Mae and like these massive kind of institutional like American banks, and almost did, but the guarantor lost their job, and it all got really stressful. So I kind of, there was always this unfinished idea that I'd do a PhD. So I got the master's in from Goldsmiths and published a book. So I thought, okay, well, I'll go and do that. And UEA took me on. So I went and did that. And by this point, you know, I wasn't making any money out of it, out of the writing, but I did realise I could make money out of teaching creative writing, because basically once you got a qualification and a publication, people will let you do teaching other people how to do it.
Presumably up until that point, you'd been writing a lot of non-fiction, academic sort of work. Did you feel the two forms of writing sort of coexisted, or were they quite separate places within your head? Of that's the fiction writing part of my head, and that's the academic writing part.
Ish.
They never kind of cross.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think they're not as different as people make out, right? I think that, I mean, particularly the kind of non-fiction academic stuff that people tend to like, right? Academics, or at least my stuff, has a narrative in it already, right? You've got to kind of basically introduce something and then develop it in the middle and then pay it off in a conclusion. And the narrative structure is basically the same as a short story or a novel, depending on how long they are. So structurally, they're not that different. I mean, materially, they have different content, I guess, and there's a kind of different style, but I don't think they're that different. And the pleasures of them are relatively similar too. They have the same kind of problems with things not working and how to fix them and how to bring things over. So, I mean, it's certainly different, a different discipline, but there are similar kind of skills involved, I think.
And is that something you'd always kind of felt, or as you've kind of worked on both, have you kind of come to more of a realization of that they're close, or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I've always felt that, but largely because what I was working on was art history and the art history of surrealism. So most of the academic work that I was doing before then, in art history, there's a lot of interpretation of images, right? And a lot of writing about what those images are, right? Mm-hmm. In one way or another, often accompanying an image, right? But you have to kind of describe things of the world in a relatively narrative sense. I mean, particularly if you're going to interpret an image that no one's interpreted before, for example. So you'll have to kind of do a description that is not unlike a description of anything else that you might do, right? And if that's also tied to a kind of story that you're trying to tell about a writer or an artist or a photographer, and you're trying to tie that into a theory, it's only really the explicit tying it into the theory part that really differs from fictional writing anyway, right? And the other way around, right, fictional writing requires you to have ideas in it. You might have to hide them, so that people just don't think, oh, Christ, I have to be a load of ideas. Where's my fun in all of this? But you don't have to hide them that much, because people still need to know that something's going on behind what you're doing. So I don't think they're that different. I mean, they're certainly not for me, and I tend to push my writing much harder in that direction than I think is commercially viable. and then I get told to rein it back in a bit. So, which we might be finding with this book that I'm writing at the moment. So, but yeah, I don't think they're that different. I think that you can certainly get to a position where you can find a middle ground between those two things and have fun, you know, kind of both on the intellectual end and on also on the kind of fictional narrative end. Yeah.
Do you think that the having formally sort of studied aesthetics and describing images and stuff, has that had an effect on how you write fiction in terms of description?
I think? Certainly made me more precise. Yeah, I think. And it kind of, it's, I don't know about all writers, but I think there's a pleasure involved in developing the things that you do. So if you've started off doing a lot of descriptive writing about things, you start getting better at it, and therefore it starts getting fun to experiment with it. Whereas other things, you know, kind of fall by the wayside, I guess. So I think, yeah, there's definitely a kind of, I hadn't really thought about it before, but definitely a kind of discipline involved in the description of images that you carry on into description of place and setting and the objects of a place. I mean, I think it's really useful in fiction in general to kind of tag narrative events and tag story to objects, because they're so much more easy to describe without boring people. So, you know, if one of the students was in today talking about something that they were working on, we decided it would be a good idea if she carried various books around with her that she could be reading, so that you wouldn't have to do anything as laboured as saying, as introducing the topic, because we'd know the topic because the book's on the topic, so you can have a book about X. And then X is then introduced into the story without having to kind of do a lot of heavy lifting on the conceptual end. So I think, yeah, I think tying things to objects, tying things to places, tying mood to description is a useful thing to do. Certainly kind of broadens your palette and your range of things that you can do with fiction, I think.
And in Grace, was there anything, I'm not familiar with it, but
no,
is there anything?
No one is. I only sold about 200 copies tops. Well, perhaps more than that, I don't know.
Anything from your art history background in that?
There was more for my reading. I mean, there might have been from the philosophical end. There was a lot on Bataille, the philosopher Georges Bataille, and which comes in through surrealism. There was a whole bunch of kind of riffs on Angela Carter and on Little Red Riding Hood and things like that. And there's a kind of good visual history for fairy tales and Little Red Riding Hood in particular that I think kind of came into there. I noticed I used colours a lot. There was a lot of red. There's a lot of red in playthings as well.
Yeah.
Oh, red and white in playthings.
It's a good colour.
Yeah, well, it maps, because the kind of pivotal scene in playthings is a scene of blood on sheets, for example. So red and white is in there as a kind of, you know, structure.
Yeah, so I mean, it's quite visceral.
Yeah, as well. So you can, you know, it puts people on edge without them realising quite why, I think.
Going back to the sort of link between academic writing and fiction, I mean, there's different approaches to sort of academic research, but quite often it might start with a thesis and then go and find some evidence for that and then create that narrative to support the thesis. Do you see fiction in a similar way, that you approach it with a sort of thesis or central idea and then build the story around it, or do you sort of write and uncover the...
Well, again, I think it's even with academic writing, right? You might start with a thesis, but I mean, that's literally with a thesis. If you're doing a PhD, for example, you may sit down with an idea that you think you want to write for a PhD, but it almost always becomes obvious that that's not a good idea and it doesn't work. And then consequently, you do find your way around and then reverse engineer the thesis. And then act as if that's what you wanted to do all along. I think that's with fiction. I think that's definitely something you might come up with. I know, you know, I'll do this. You think to yourself, I know, let's have a go at doing this. And then that thing is the most tedious and kind of pointless thing in the world when you actually start to write it down. But whatever it is that you're left with on the page that isn't tedious and kind of rubbish is something that you then run with. And then you act as if that was your intention. I mean, the plaything started off as a kind of attempt to write in the style of Schreber, a whole continuation of his memoirs, right? And that was how I began it. And there's a lot of material still from that period that that I was writing, but that all got cut because it was shit. And consequently, what's the point of doing it? It became obvious to me that there wasn't any point in doing that. So something else happened instead. So I think even academic work is of that order. I think mostly people are reverse engineering their kind of intentions after the event. Even scientists, I mean, I think they'll sit down to do one thing, discover something else, and then I devised an experiment to test this, but only after they've done loads of flawed thinking and thought work on it. Most of the stuff takes place on the page.
And the process then of having a general field more that you're interested
yeah,
in.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, yeah.
A thesis that is...
I think there's a difference between the self that wants to do things and has ideas about what they want to do and the self that does them, right? And then I'm not sure how close those things ever get, right? And then, but the self that does stuff does things in the way that it can do them, right? It and sometimes it develops and improves and that kind of stuff, right? And then the self that wants to do things has to look at it and think, well, what can I do? What have I done? It's like, then they look at them and think, okay, well, you know, the self that does things knows better than me, right? So we'll go with what the self that does things is doing. That makes sense. So you know, sit down with it on a, you know, with an idea of what you're going to do that day for writing. You think, okay, well, I'm going to write 3,000 words or whatever today. Whatever, I am going to do that, and I'm going to do it on this topic. This is where I left off last time. I'm going to do that, right? And then by 9:30, 10 o'clock, the whole thing's gone. And something else is there, and then you just have to run with that. I mean, I think trying to rein the whole thing in is kind of something you would only do periodically, right? Mm. You just let it run and then see what you got at the end of it. If it's no good, you can always, you know, say.
So is there a sense of sort of limiting any communication between those two selves? Only letting the critical self have a look every couple of weeks?
Yeah, I think. I don't let the critical self have a look at the stuff that the other one does. It can look at the very end of the thing that was done the day before and the general sense of where you've progressed to. And then it can then decide overnight, well, what are we going to try and do today? And then we'll just have to chase after the thing that does the work. Because, you know, really, I mean, I'm not making this up, but I don't really feel in control of the thing that gets written. I don't know how it gets there. I don't know who's doing the thinking of it. I don't know who's planning it. I don't know how they're doing it. So consequently, when it's out, you know, when you've probably got into the rhythm of writing and you've just done what it is that you, the number of words that I set for myself that day, then I'll have to deal with whatever that turned out to be later. It's very true, this last one.
How much do you consciously plan before you start, before the first draft?
None. Well, in terms of plot and things like that.
I mean, obviously you have to have an idea about where you're going to aim for to begin with, whether or not you get there. But yeah, you don't have a sort of a whiteboard covered in notes or anything like that.
No, I mean, as you get towards the end, I think, I mean, and say that, like, if you're galloping through a first draft and you're just writing down the stuff that comes, you know, that it's like a bit like that Exquisite Corpse game that, you know, surrealists used to play with the drawings. They'll fold over, someone will draw a head and then you fold it over and then someone draws the torso and then you fold it over and someone draws the legs. It's a bit like that, I think. But then eventually you unfold the thing and there is a thing, and then you have to start rubbing bits out, adding bits on, otherwise no one will buy it, right? Or you put your publishers in an extremely difficult position of having to try and sell an unmarketable book, for example. And at that point you have to start, okay, well, the discipline of what do I want, what would a good book of this type that other people would read look like? And then you have to go back and kind of make the book that you did write look like that, I think.
So you're not uncompromising at the idea that it does have to be...
No, I mean... Well, no, I mean... I have plenty of novels that haven't been sold. So, and the kind of... So that, and if whatever the next one that you write happens to be one of those, then it happens to be one of those. But I think after a while, you get to the point where you think, well, I had my fun while I was writing it. The fun part is letting the thing that does, the person who does the work, do the work, and being able to do that, which is a great privilege. I mean, if you're not slaving away in a kitchen, like, you know, from 5 o'clock in the morning till 2 o'clock the following morning, then it's a privilege that you get to be able to do some writing. I got the university paid for me to take the term before last off, right, for example, so I didn't have to come to work, although I still did have to come to work because there was other things that needed to be done, but technically I didn't have to come to work. And that's other people paying for you to write, right? But that fund, once that fund's done, then there are obligations you've got to... I mean, like Galley Beggar, who are a great press and deserve all the support they can get, and deserve people to buy their books because they're producing excellent books, also deserve some writers who are capable of not being as self-indulgent as a writer would like to be. And I think you can find a middle ground. I mean, my aim is largely to produce work that I'm happy with in the mould of work that other people are happy with, right? One way or the other. I mean, I can write for myself whenever I want. I can imagine brilliant books. I wouldn't even have to go to the trouble of writing them. Sit there and imagine these brilliant things that I've done. And I can do that in my own time. But when it gets to books that, you know, you're eventually going to be on a shelf or in a shop, or, you know, that other people are going to read, then I think you do have to take other people's feelings into consideration one way or the other. You know, particularly the people who are going to have to pay for the printer, because those people deserve.
Going back quickly just to the sort of creation process of the self that's actually churning the words out, do you have any process of getting to the point where those words are coming onto the page? Is it a case of sitting around trying to close off distractions? Or
no, I mean, I think after having... Because I've always written, right? So times in which I've written, of which I've been unemployed, for example, when I was on the dole, I used to write loads in my 20s. And I think I set myself a model then, right? So those student days and kind of, you know, times in which I haven't been at work, then I would just write because it improved my sense of kind of self-worth and being in the world. And it just made me less tense to be able to write, set up a kind of whole kind of self system where writing is a thing that you want to do, right? And consequently, when people take it away because you've got adult responsibilities and work and other things, and not being published, which happens for a long time, and having to do a whole bunch of other stuff, then that desire to do it is so kind of repressed and so kind of backed up that when you do get the opportunity to do it, you just do it. I mean, I'm not saying that there's no such thing as writer's block, because I'm sure there is. At the same time, that's a privilege that I don't have time for. So, I mean, some of the stuff that I've got written recently was written during the writing exercises I set students, for example. So if we're doing a class, sometimes there's a 20-minute writing exercise, sometimes as long as half an hour, very rarely, if there's something complicated that they need to do. And I write during that time too, right? So I don't have time to sit around getting into the mode. I just take the break off, right? Just, you know, because it's as if there's a writing Alex who's just like champing at the bit all the time.
And does that writing Alex, does he have sort of one project at a time? Is it one thing? You sort of sit down, okay, I've got some time to write now.
I've got a million different things on the go at once. I mean, as things get towards the end, like I tend to concentrate on that because I get a sense of well-being out of progress then, right? But up until that point, I mean, if I begin something, I mean, generally I write short, but sometimes I write long, and I can sense that the midway point has been passed, then I tend to kind of concentrate just on one thing, or one thing very much kind of occupies, you know, kind of planning and thinking Alex, who goes over the whole stuff and thinks, well, what the fuck is all this supposed to be? What have you done? This is not going to make any sense. Everybody's going to hate you, and it's just going to be nonsensical, and it'll be another one of those things that never gets finished. And that person bothers away, and then writing Alex deals with it the following day. Or not, you know. And if, you know, I'm also happy to relegate things to Word documents that are never going to be opened again. So there's a vast amount of material that is not worthless, but just wasn't any use, you know.
Does that ever come back years later?
Yeah. Well, I mean, on and off. I mean, I've got whole novels that I'd kind of consigned to the, yeah, that was a good idea, seemed like a good idea at the time. But then other people sometimes read them, and then you have to polish them off and kind of send them out again. So, which is good. I mean, if I ever do get colossally blocked, then there's other material that I can send out.
I saw the time approaching when I would be left alone of the party of Unsound Method. The pilgrims looked upon me with disfavor.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Unsound Methods. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods or via our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
So thinking that process of making it good, does the sort of thinking Alex, when he's looking this up, do you find it can get in the way, sort of almost knowing too much about literary theory or other aspects of process?
I don't know. I mean, other people, it would be up to other people to decide. If people find my stuff intellectual and mannered, then I guess I'll have to say yes to that. But I mean, I don't feel that that's true. I think most of the stuff that you pick up through intellectualizing about things is relatively simple anyway. I mean, Aristotle's simple, right? You know, beginnings, middles, and ends are simple. There's nothing, you know, it's just a beginning is the bit where you start and the end is the bit where you finish, right? And in the middle, there's stuff. Right? It's not that much more complicated than that. But sometimes you can lose track of that. And, you know, just simple things that can help you with those are things that you...
I guess I think more of, you know, looking back over something, thinking, oh, I need to change this in a certain way, and spending an afternoon changing it, and then going, actually, no, it was fine in the first place.
That's why I keep multiple drafts of everything. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think that editorial process is necessary, though. I mean, and I can't change me. So I've always been academically minded. I mean, my dad was a philosopher, so I kind of was brought up on philosophy. And I'm interested in the things that I'm interested in. And consequently, I can't really do much about that. I try not to write stuff that only philosophers would like.
I don't think that's a bad thing.
I don't either, but there's not that many of them. That's what I'm trying to think. There's only a few philosophers left, unfortunately. And consequently, you can't really sell them loads of books. But, I don't know. I think the editorial thing is useful. You've got to have both, because you can't just then send things unformed into the world. And that editorial side, it's useful to know why something's not working, right? It's one of those things that, particularly if you're getting editorial notes from publishers, and they'll say, well, there's just something here that I'm not quite getting, or I don't really understand why, or I thought this was boring, or I'm not engaged here. You can generally understand, if someone says they're not engaged with something, it generally means you've done something wrong with the character work, or you need to kind of beef up some part of it, or, you know, add terrible things like Jeopardy and all that kind of malarkey. Sort of bring back callbacks, or, you know, whatever it is, you can find some way to fix things to other people's satisfaction. And I mean, really, most readers, even if they are publishers and editors, or people who should, you know, kind of know things, they're relatively easily manipulated. I mean, generally, if it's like jokes, you know, you'll laugh at a joke even if you know how it's structured. You know, you set up a situation, you do something surprising in the middle, and you pay it off with a punchline. And generally, most fiction will work that way. And knowing that is useful. You can't intuit everything anymore. I mean, you might have been able to at one point if you're kind of beat novelist or something, but even that, you know, I think they had editors.
You generally find it easy to put your finger on that. If once you're talking to a publisher, especially, they come back and say, oh, there's just something here that's not working, or this character. Do you generally see eye to eye with that?
I think it comes down to the I've had my fun part of it. So, I mean, now it's just being respectful of other people's kind of being in the world. If other people want to invest in your... I mean, take Sam, for example. Sam's editing my next book. I want him to be able to be enthusiastic about it, right, when he goes out and has to sell it, or when he has to talk about it, and just to be happy that it's on his books, right? And it's his and Ellie's publishing house, right? It's their thing. No, so it would be extremely rude of me, as much as anything else, to kind of stamp my foot and say, well, that's how I wanted it to be, so I'm going to do it. Because it's not about... I mean, it will still be how I wanted it to be, but hopefully it will also be how Sam wants it to be. So,
what are some of the more difficult aspects of that sort of... not a clash, but when there's a difference of opinion on a
defensiveness, I think, for me, because, you know, then I suddenly get to the point where I hate the world, I hate what I've written, I hate everything. So, and then I've got to somehow, you know, kind of work myself. Generally, there'll be a problem, right? If if someone else doesn't like what you've done, a specific someone else who you respect, then the chances are that there's a problem in there that you haven't seen because you're too close to it. Or generally with me, that's taking too much for granted. It's assuming that other people will be able to get the effects that I'm striving for without knowing what I know, right? So because you know what you're writing about. So consequently, if someone isn't getting the effects, it's probably because I haven't told them, or I haven't set those effects up properly, or I haven't told people what it is that they should be feeling at various points.
That balance is really difficult. To know how much knowledge to assume on the part of the reader.
Yeah, especially when you're working with people who existed, right? With the Schreiber stuff, for example, there's a vast amount of material that I made myself privy to before the book started. And no one essentially could really be expected to have known all of that. So there's a lot of, you have to put some generic material in there, right? So that people could just understand human beings as human beings in the book. Otherwise, it's almost asking people to say, well, go away, familiarize yourself with all of these books and then come back and read this book and then see how you get on. And I think it is hard. I mean, because you don't want to bore people by telling them things that they could get in other places. But simultaneously, if they need to know, they need to know. The other option, of course, is if there are things that people need to have background information on to get the effect, right? Then you have to cut it and put something else that gets that effect there, right? Which is fine. one day it's like director's cuts of movies. I mean, like Blade Runner, for example, they put the voiceover at the beginning of Blade Runner, right? When they took it out, right, with the director's cut, because he didn't want to explain anything, it was just Harrison Ford sat there staring into the, like, and in my head all I could hear was the voiceover. And I was like, well, why is he sitting there? Because they, for some reason, he was Ridley Scott was attached enough to the visual side of it not to have taken the scene where the voiceover used to be out, right, when he should have done, because it's just a guy sat there like that. Well, like 30 seconds of voiceover goes on, but the voiceover's not there now, right? So at some point there may be, on my laptop, there will be director's cuts of all sorts of books that are no use to anybody. They're full of, like that, full of people sitting there silently while the explication of the scene is not read out, right? Because I already know it. But that's no good to anybody else, and it's not a better book because I'm self-indulging, I think.
So, because obviously there you were in Playthings, you were working with someone who was real, for whom there was some information about. I know you suggested when we spoke the other night you're having problems, particularly with the Joyce estate. But does that mean if you write about someone who is real, do you get people who are absolute experts in it?
Oh, yeah.
Play this kind of one-upmanship.
Well, the thing is, with
tiny mistakes that you've made.
The thing is, with people, I mean, with Schreiber, that did happen, and people who know a lot about Schreiber, it's not sufficient. I mean, to know a lot about someone, that you don't get. No one says, oh, "Okay, well done for knowing a lot about a particular subject." You also have to have an opinion on it, and generally an axe to grind. And there's lots of different axes to grind in the Schreiber end. There's all sorts of different psychoanalytic theories that Schreiber gets used for, all sorts of different social theories that Schreiber gets used for. So what will happen is you'll get critiques of a novel, for example, on the basis that they don't match someone's academic theory about Schreiber, right? Or it doesn't match it well enough, or peddles some myth that person thinks oughtn't to be peddled. Blah, 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 right? So there was one of a very famous expert on Schreiber who wrote a kind of 19-page refutation of my book in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association. But he wasn't really talking about the book. He was talking about how much these kind of warring factions in Schreiber studies despise each other, and how he felt that my book had fallen into one or other of those camps, mistakenly.
How do you see the kind of connection from the sort of real world? You mentioned you sort of had a good amount of research that you'd already sort of consumed before starting any writing. Was that the sort of jumping off point? And from there you just let the creative process happen based on what you knew, or was it a constant back and forth?
It's a negotiation between all of those things. I mean, as it turned out, relatively well, as far as I felt, but all of that stuff we were talking about on the generic let's make a book that people want to read end comes into play. So whatever idea I had, because the idea was essentially that I would try and make an academic argument about Schreber, about Schreber studies in particular, and how it had failed to figure the role of women, for example, in Schreber's illness, okay, which it does. It's not great at figuring the role of women. So if you wanted to, if you knew enough, you could read Playthings as a kind of drop in. You just, okay, well, here's the material that you've missed out. I haven't done it academically. This is the kind of material that you might want to... should have thought about Schreber studies, but didn't, right? I mean, that's kind of one way. Another way I was thinking about it was, let's write a book that could be psychoanalyzed in the same way that Schreber could be psychoanalyzed if you do figure women into it. So you create a figure or a book itself that is psychoanalyzable in the same way as the memoirs were. But that's all thinking Alex's stuff. Doing Alex, you have to come in and do whatever he does, right? And I have to then, you know, I kind of work with that. And then there's all the other people in the world who might want to read things, and people like Sam and Ellie who wanted things clarified or things taken in. Some chapters were left out. Some things that Sam particularly rightly thought were melodramatic got toned down. And it becomes a negotiation between all of those different
On a sort of practical day-to-day, as you're writing it, say, you know, you've got 500 words down, are you then sort of thinking, oh, I need to check something about Schreber and going to the internet?
Yeah.
Or was it because of...
Well, I have a million books. They're not all these ones. They're behind most of these because I'm not using them at the moment. But there's a whole bunch of, oh, here's some. That one, that one, that one. I'm pointing to books are all kind of canonical Schreber texts, right? There's some really good ones. The guy who slated the book has wrote this really useful kind of 500-600 page tome on Schreber and Schreber's father. This one, In Defense of Schreber, which is excellent, as is this one, Israel's Schreber Father and Son, which are all full of like primary material, which is useful to check against if you need to do something. So yeah, in and out during that process, but I try not to do it because I'm really obsessed with numbers, right? And I have to, if I've said I'm going to write 3,000 words in a day, then I have to get to 3,000 words, and anything that makes me feel like that's not going to happen, I become, you know, kind of anxious about. If I get over my word target, I'm really delighted. And I'd be happy all day.
3,000 words is...
I can knock out 3,000 to 5,000.
Because that's quite a high bar to
take. Oh, yeah.
It's obviously, you say, the work ethic you got when you were unemployed and sort of do that. But that is, I think, 3,000 sounds like a big old chunk to begin with.
Yeah, writers will tell you that that's a lot, but it isn't. Just like, and you don't use all of them. You know, you have to edit the thing. I mean, it might be a complete dog's dinner, but I mean, you know, compared to working for a living, writing 3,000 words in a day, I mean, if you set yourself, what's Graham Greene, 500 words or something, you know, but then didn't he used to knock that out before 9 in the morning? I mean, and then he was off at the club for the rest of the day. I mean, if you take it seriously, just don't go to the club and sit at home until the bloody thing's written.
His method worked out okay.
Yeah, it was all right for him. But then I think a lot of this gets imported from a very kind of upper class view of what a writer does. You know, you look at someone like James Kelman, he doesn't sit around worrying about, you know,
the club.
The club. He was a bus driver. You know, he had to get the work done before he could, you know, you can't, you know, if you've got the privilege of a day to write, I mean, you should use it. I mean, not to say like some kind of saint. I mean, you will end up watching Twin Peaks or whatever, then, you know, because sometimes your brain needs downtime. But, you know, to imagine that, you know, writing 5, 6, 10,000 words in a day is a kind of gargantuan task, I think, is to overplay the difficulty inherent in sitting in front of a typewriter. I mean, as long as you've got a decent typing speed, you should be able to rattle that off.
And do those words, the 3,000 per day, do they kind of tend to sit in a sort of linear...
No, what I do is
I have Word docs with...
I got a Word document
15,
for every day.
20,000 here.
Well, it depends. If you finish something, right, if you finish a chapter, then that's that chapter finished. If you haven't quite finished a chapter, then I kind of page break and start something else. I try not to look at what I've done, because if I look at what I've done, then I start editing, and then, you know, Thinking Alex comes in and he's no use for getting bodies of work done. He's just no use.
Will you sort of jump around within, like, thinking of playthings, jump around from, oh, I've got an idea of a scene while he's, you know, later on in the story in the asylum, I'll write that now, but I've still not finished writing the opening section and jump between the...
Definitely. I don't have any problem doing that at all. I mean, it depends. You have to have a kind of relatively solid idea of where the plot's going to go, right? But sometimes there are things that you could use in kind of interchangeably anywhere. So lots of the times, Schreiber will be having visions or going off into kind of reveries. Those you can write and then drop in wherever they seem appropriate, right? And as long as you've kind of managed the movement between the real and the reverie adequately, which is a kind of Thinking Alex's job, then you can kind of tie them in anywhere. Grace, I wrote all out of order. It was all completely out of order, then I pieced it together in order.
And does that change quite a lot? Do you sort of have a draft and then read through and think, oh no, that whole section needs to be...
Yeah. Sometimes it needs to be gone. Sometimes it needs to be earlier. So if I move that bit later, Sam wanted me to rearrange the chronology of this last book because I'd done it out of time, which he considered to be, thought it was confusing, I think, or just didn't give much sense of progression in terms of the characterization. So you make the accommodations necessary to change things around. Most stuff you can fit in various directions. If you need things to be flashbacks and flash forwards, then fine. And if you need to be things in to be chronological order, then fine. If most of that material is you can fix with structure. So if you just bring in a structural trick here and there, you can reorder things to your heart's content. So I certainly edit out of order and often write out of order. Just dropping in, and because that's the good thing about kind of productive Alex is he can, and the bad thing, he can write a lot, but only on the topics he feels are interesting to him. So you can't make him do a whole load of stuff that you need to be done. Yeah. Editing Alex can be forced to do anything because, you know.
He's well trained.
Well, he has to be. He's got no choice. He's only got a finite amount of time before he has to go into the next lesson, so he can't be sat around, you know, kind of crying or whatever. Beat him!
With novels, now that you've got a good relationship with Gally Vega, how finished is it before, in your mind? Is this it's finished, that's the thing, even though you know that things will come back?
Well, Playthings was completely finished as far as I was concerned. It had been finished for a long time, because this was before I knew Sam and Ellie. So when I gave it to them, as far as I was concerned, it was finished. And basically it was. We cut a couple of chapters and moved some bits and pieces around, and that was about it. With the latest one, they got a first draft, so they got in quite early in the process. Largely because I wanted them to, because I respect their opinion, I wanted them to see whether it was something that was going to work before I spent much more time getting a finished draft together. And it's not changing enormously, but the structuring devices, as I was talking to you about the other day, the structuring devices around it that are going to make it read as a narrative need work. So, which I think I've solved now. Uh-huh. So, I think I've got it. Thinking Alex can work quickly too. He has to. Again, structure is easy. There are rules for structure. You can feel your way around structure. If progression is relatively easy, if you have like 15 scenes, you use 3 of them for setup. You use 7 for the middle, and you use 5 for paying it all off. And if you can work out where those are going to be, if you can think of what the payoff is going to be, then you can kind of block those out relatively easily and then worry about exactly how that's written later. I think it's generally, I'm not as established a novelist as lots of people. So someone like Toby Litt, who is bringing a book out with Gally Vega, a non-fiction book out either later this year or early next year. Has written, I don't know, 20? I mean, how far is he up the alphabet now? I don't know. So, and has worked with various publishers, whereas, you know, I've only worked with 2, and this is my 3rd novel. So each one is different, essentially. I mean, I didn't have any editorial feedback at all on the first novel, a little bit on the second, and more so on this one. And I think... It's not that I like it. I don't like it. It makes me very, very uncomfortable and unhappy to receive notes. I don't, but I get over it, you know. And once there's an enormous kind of fun and joy to be had in fixing something in a different way and still being as happy with it. Do you know what I mean? It's just a fun thing, I think. It's like a puzzle, right? And puzzles can be extremely frustrating while you're doing them, but when it's done, you're like, hey, look, and you get that kind of sense of, oh, aren't I clever? Look, and I had a difficult thing to do and I did it. Good boy. And then away you go. I think they're getting in quite early, so it's interesting. We'll see how that turns out. I mean, I don't know.
Does that give you sort of freedom to be more adventurous with what you're doing?
I don't know. I think I have as much freedom to be adventurous as I like, really. I mean, I don't make my living out of selling books, right? So if the worst comes to the worst, and say they didn't want to publish it, I'm not going to take a financial hit. I still have the fun of writing it, and I'll keep on writing anyway. I don't think that's likely to happen. But this idea that I think, you know, commercial writers may have a set of very strict editorial guidelines that they have to hit, right? Which is obvious because you've got a fan base and a kind of readership that you need to please. With Gally Beggar, it's really useful because they bear the brunt of that, right? They have the fan base. It's Gally Beggar books that people buy. People don't buy Alex Phoebe books. They might do one day, but they don't at the moment. So consequently, I don't have any expectations to meet, and I just get to do whatever it is that I want. As I always have done, and will probably carry on going. You know, if people want to publish them, then good. That's good, and it's fun to go through that process. But I couldn't start out thinking I know what I'd do. I'll make the compromises a priori, and then I don't know. I don't know how that works. I don't know how that would work if someone commissioned me, which never happened. If someone was to say, "Well, Alex, is, you know, we'll give you 10 grand." If you go away and write this book on X, then I'd approach it differently, I think. But that's not generally the way it's working. It's kind of like, well, what are you doing now, Alex? I'm doing this. Oh, that sounds good. Yeah, and then can we have a look at that now? Because, you know, they pay for two books. So so I was submitting, it was about Christmas, I submitted the first draft of Lucia to them. And then Ellie said she liked it. So that was that. If she said, I don't like it, then I'd have either reworked something that I'd already done or started something else. Because I think it depends. If people say they really like something, but they think it needs changes, that's one thing. If people say they don't like something, there's not much you can do about that. I mean, what are you going to do? Mm. You just have to do something else.
Well, I guess, as you say, you're not dependent on
the income. I mean, kind of in the long term, I am. I mean, if I stop ever publishing books and eventually the students say, well, what do you think gives you the right to teach me creative writing? Although I don't think that would kick in for quite a long time because I got a doctorate in it and books published. So I think that probably allows me to keep my job for a decade, easy. So I've got some leeway. But I think it's just, I'm in a really enviable position. If I'd have been really happy, let's put it this way, if I'd have been when at 20 and thought to myself, okay, well, what are you be doing in your 40s? Whatever you like, and then someone's going to kind of publish it, you know, with certain provisos, and I'd have been delighted. You know, and I'd been delighted to work with people like Sam and Ellie, who are really, really, really good editors, and they know what they're talking about. They're bright human beings, and, you know, they both write themselves, and they're kind of good at what they do. And I've met a lot of really interesting writers through them, and I respect their opinion.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the show. We'd love to hear any feedback or suggestions you have. Find us online at unsoundmethods.co.uk and add any comments about this episode or suggestions for future editions of the show.
Going back quickly to playthings, but I think it is a fantastic sort of evocation of this mind unhinged, becoming unhinged. It's obviously quite a huge subject to look at, the sort of madness and schizophrenia, and I guess maybe possibly tying into the discussion we've been having of the two Alexes.
Yeah.
What do you see, if any, connection between the process of sitting down and creating a fictional world and putting together sentences and grammatical structures that conjure up this world that doesn't exist, and somebody with a mental disease who sits in a room and conjures up fictional universes and believes in them?
Yeah.
Is there any connection between those processes?
No, there isn't, and I'll tell you why. I think it's a missed question to a certain extent, in that I think all forms of reality building are of the same order, right? The sitting down and writing the novel thing is a reality building exercise. The bit where you come up and you come into the building where I work, right? Somewhere that you're not as familiar with as your usual environment. Dealing with that is an act of reality building. It's looking at this and making sense of it and deciding what it is to you and whether you need to be fearful of it or whether you can be comfortable in it. Just as it is when you get off the tube at, 2 o'clock in the morning in North London, right? South London, so I don't like North London. In North London, the whole place is like, whoa, what's... That is, then a reality building has to take place at that point, the bit where you start to think about yourself and talk about yourself and think about others and talk about, that's a whole reality building exercise in and of itself. And what separates the ones that we choose to pathologize or to call fiction or to unreal in some other ways is a matter of tone as much as anything. I mean, is it anxious, right? It's kind of... There is something anxious about fiction writing, and there's something anxious about being mentally ill. I think those two things are certainly true, but often people's lives are anxious too. I mean, and you go through your life feeling anxious, and subjectively, when you're writing, there's a kind of reality of the thing that you're doing. You don't feel it as a reader because you have that distance, but you've a piece of writing a novel. For me, because I'm primarily a novelist, itself has a kind of aesthetic wholeness about it that is real in and of itself, and of the same order as the kind of thing that I might imagine. I'd gone to a reading, right? And then I look back on that reading in my head. I'm fictionalizing all of those things at the same time. I may have been there, but I'm not there in the present. And consequently, it is as basically the same thing as me conceptualizing a fictional world, but I am doing. I'm fictionalizing on the real, which is what you do with novels anyway. So consequently, all reels are the same as a schizophrenic reel or a fictional reel or a real reel. They're all things that you do in the meat box, like that you're caged in, and convince yourself in one way or another, either have kind of certain levels of ontological kind of depth that either they do or don't possess. I mean, but that question, what degree of ontological certainty can you place on various constructions in your mind, right, is very loaded. it's very, and I mean, it's political, it's kind of psychological, it's philosophical. They're not simple things. You can't really, it seems to me, draw a distinction between things that are real and things that aren't real. To the extent that real and unreal just don't mean anything. I mean, they are...
Is there not some element of it that in the general parlance, something that's real is something that there's sensory data for and generally agreed sensory data. I mean, I'm not
You're
disputing...
an empiricist the, you. I don't know, it depends if you want to kind of rub out the last 200 years of philosophy.
These things that people, everyone agrees that they can...
Do they? You're a Kantian, are you? that notion that everybody agrees on something, right? I mean, you come to me with an experience that you've lived, okay? I neither agree with you nor disagree, right? I can either trust that you're being honest or that you aren't being honest, right? Now, if you have schizophrenia, in what way is that different, right? You come to me and when you're explaining whatever your life is to me, right, I have to give you whatever faith I give you as another subjective human being, right? Consequently, the argument kind of comes down to what is it about schizophrenia and schizophrenics that we don't give that trust to, right? Or people with different value systems to us. I'm writing a book now there's a lot of about Egyptian mythology in it, right? Now, we're generally going to agree probably that whatever the rituals that one takes does over the mummy of a corpse aren't going to ensure their everlasting afterlife, right? I mean, we don't tend to agree on that now. At the time, they did. At the time, that would have been a perfectly reasonable thing. You mummify the corpse, you decorate the tomb with the things that the dead person is going to receive in the afterlife, and then you perform magical rituals over it to ensure that those things happen, right? I can't... What do I think is so true about the world that I live in that I would feel so comfortable over overruling whatever they believed about their world, right? And you don't have to do it chronologically, you can just do it geographically. Why is it that, or even not even geographic, culturally, what is it that I believe that I believe trumps someone who believes in God? Or trumps Trump, right? Donald Trump may have the ontological certainty about the way he exists in the world that means all other people are wrong, but I don't feel that certainty, and I certainly wouldn't claim it. So consequently, I don't feel I should be in a position to be pre-vetting and trusting various people's reels as they are presented to me. But then I should just make good faith arguments that those things that people say to me that they think are true, because otherwise I'm kind of dogmatically enforcing some kind of Alex-based view of the world and other people's views of the world, which would be unethical, right? So when we ask the question, what we all agree, right, that something is real, right, or that their common parlance is a kind of fascism of ideological certainty, right? Because there isn't in all of us. I mean, even in this room, there's three of us here. You two might agree, but because I don't, I might not. I don't know whatever you're going to say. That doesn't mean you two are right. You two may well be wrong.
I try and maybe rephrase the question.
Right,
I think what I was interested in is the difference between a sort of willful desire to create fiction,
right,
which I think is aiming for a certain truth, and a more realistic truth. You talked about coming up the stairs here. I was, you know, in a new place. I've never been up those stairs before, and I was trying to make sense of that world. And, you know, I tried to see where the banister was so I didn't fall off and kill myself. And that was trying to understand what the world was.
Well,
and I wasn't trying to willfully play around with it. And
no, but that's because
if I went off the edge of the stairs, it would be
dangerous.
In
that specific situation, though, you've been provided with a world that reifies your worldview, right? You know that stairs have got banisters on them. Right? So you'll look for the banister, and someone has thoughtfully provided a banister for you. And there's the banister, and that will help you. That's a very limited set of situations outside an architectural framework like this, or the city, or your own place, right, that allows you to feel that kind of level of certainty because you're having that reified by the built environment. Right. If you go into the countryside, you go into somewhere you're not familiar with, you go into a culture you're not familiar with, those things don't exist. If you go in the middle of Shinjuku at 11 o'clock at night and then try and cross the road with a whole bunch of Japanese people, you'll probably be arrested because you don't know the rules, right? You don't know that it's not allowable to step into the traffic until the thing does exactly what it does, and you don't even know where that thing is or what that thing is, right? And that is not dissimilar to the same feeling of being out of place that people with certain illnesses might experience, for example. So it's even when you're in a position of having a level of certainty over the self, right, you only get that because your built environment allows you to live through that. So I'm never that convinced that we're not only a kind of a shift in place or a shift in culture away from being in exactly the same position as someone who has an illness feels in the places that we expect them to feel comfortable in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and is fiction then a sort of way of exploring those edges?
Possibly. I think it's also just a way of talking about people, right? I think that there is something inherent in looking at people who are slightly unanchored, right? Or perhaps, let's say, I feel more attuned to people who feel unanchored in the world than I do with people who feel very certain and anchored in the world. Because I don't feel terribly anchored in the world. I don't think I've got an illness, but I don't think it's far off that experience, right? And we've all had mental health problems, and we all will. And there are times when you're going to feel more or less in control of things, right? And I think it's one of those important understandings that people have, that is the case. And I think it's the opposite of that being the case, where everyone feels very anchored and certain about things, that causes problems, because they're sure that they're right in all circumstances, despite the fact that they're only right in a very limited range of circumstances in which their privilege is being built into the society. And the moment you take that privilege out, you're in the position of being wrong, right? To other people's rights.
Yeah.
And then your rights get undermined in various ways. And you get yourself in stupid situations like we're in now.
I think if you see it, talking about Trump, situation in the States at the moment seems to be getting more and more divisive between...
There's only a certain level of... we might look at white supremacists and think, what a ridiculous load of idiots. But it's only an enormous certainty in themselves that gives them the position where they think it's inappropriate to make a Hitler salute, for example. Even any book, pick up a book, right, that has any relevance to the real world, will tell anybody who reads it that that's probably not a good idea, right? But they must feel whatever it is that their culture establishes them with such certainty that they think all of those other things are wrong, right? Now, that is a dangerous place for everybody to be in, and liberals as much as fascists, right? You can't be sitting around in this understanding that everything that you do is right, because you're wrong. It isn't. I have these arguments with my kids. My kids are becoming vegetarians, which is very laudable. But you only have to say to them, okay, well, where are we going to buy these vegetables, right? And you go, okay, well, we'll go to Sainsbury's and we'll buy the vegetables, okay? But Sainsbury's also sell chicken, right? So what if they use the money that you bought vegetables with to buy chicken? Right? Then what do you do? And you're like, and then we have these arguments. Well, I'm only eating. I wouldn't eat it. So if I don't eat it, then that's one less chicken being eaten. But if they use the vegetable money to subsidize chicken production, then we're all trying to do the right thing, right? We're all trying to be right. Just do the right thing. But it becomes impossible, right? Because systemically, you're living in a world that is wrong. And it does a whole bunch of wrong stuff 24 hours a day. And I think to a certain extent, if I've got a political kind of axe to grind, it's that the real is wrong. It's just wrong, ethically wrong. Just to have this notion of the real that is that certain is just wrong.
Do you feel fiction then has a sort of... The aim of fiction is to unsettle people from
it. It would be if I had any control over it, yeah. but production Alex does his own thing, so I just have to deal with whatever he does, and then act ethically as I can in my own life. I don't. This is the trouble with if you grew up in a continental philosophy household, as I did, the real is very useful politically, right? You can do all sorts of stuff. If the left have control of the real, it's great. We're all having a great time. But where on times in which the right has control over the real and the left then tries to undermine the notion of the real, it becomes very difficult to overturn the right's control of the real. Does that make sense? So even though the real is wrong, it's a wrong-headed thing to have, it can sometimes be very, very useful. If you want to have a revolution, for example, that then it's very useful to have a notion of the real, because you know who it is you're supposed to kill, right? And various things you're supposed to burn and things that you're supposed to topple, right? So the notion of a very loose real is hard.
Presumably from a more practical writing perspective, having a narrative arc, you need to have the real within that world that you're describing and know where... Which things are real?
The subjective real. Yeah, you do. But I think then it becomes your duty to muck that about. So Playthings ends not even from Schreber's perspective, right? Because he's lost even his perspective, and it ends from his mother's perspective, of which he is a kind of small part. So I think you can still muck around with that. This trouble with the real is you're in it. So, what are you supposed to do? But it doesn't make it any more defensible, philosophically speaking.
So that was Alex Phoebe. We hope you enjoyed this show. You can add any comments or suggestions at our website, unsoundmethods.co.uk, and you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
And I'm at Jamie Batchen on Twitter, or my website is jamiebatchen.com. We've heard word spoken that liking and rating us on the various platforms will help us be more visible to other people searching for literary fiction podcasts. I'm sure there's many people out there looking for them. So if you do have the time to just click on a few stars, perhaps 5 of the stars, then that would be very useful for us. Thank you.
This episode is going out on Wednesday the 11th of April, and we will be at the London Book Fair today, so hopefully see some of you there.
Yeah, come up and say hi, and we'll do our best to get round and shake hands and introduce ourselves.